First case on our calendar, 04-1568, State of Ohio versus Andrew Foster. Ms. Hare.
May it please the court, Mr. Chief Justice, I would like to reserve 3 minutes of rebuttal.
Watch your time there.
Thank you. The holding of Blakely versus Washington could not be described as anything but simple and straightforward. Indeed, it's probably one of the simplest and most straightforward of the holdings handed down by the High Court over the last 100 or so years pertaining to criminal procedure. It is that any fact that increases the penalty for a crime beyond the prescribed statutory maximum must be submitted to a jury and proved beyond a reasonable doubt. The holding arises from long-standing bedrock principles of common law, which became constitutionalized when the framers adopted our Sixth Amendment, and that is that the truth of every accusation should be confirmed by the unanimous suffrage of 12 of a defendant's peers. As simple as the idea is and as simple as the holding is, the state and the, quite frankly, with all due respect, the lower courts throughout Ohio have tried to complicate things in an effort to avoid this holding. And indeed, that's the only way you can avoid the holding is to complicate it.
Well, counsel, the same people that decided to Blakely seem to have more than a little bit of difficulty when they tried a practical application of it in Fanfan.
Your Honor, I agree that the practical application in Fanfan and that arises from Booker is difficult.
Yeah. So, I mean, isn't that our problem? We understand the rule, but how is that to be applied to our sentencing scheme, and in particular to your client?
Under our sentencing scheme, my client, convicted of primarily fourth and fifth degree felonies and one second degree felony, had certain entitlements, if you will, as recognized by Justice Scalia and Blakely. The defendant is entitled to a lesser sentence, and that entitlement cannot be removed without further finding a fact, Blakely applies. So in Mr. Foster's case, for example, he was entitled to minimum sentences, which he received on the second degree felony. He was entitled, if you would, to community control on—
What fact did the trial judge find that elevated his sentence that a jury was required to find instead?
The trial court presumably based on a pre-sentence investigation, because the facts aren't articulated at the sentencing hearing, but the trial court found that to sentence him, to give him a lesser sentence, to give him the statutory minimums in the case would demean the seriousness of the crime and would not take into account the harm caused by the various offenses. To make those findings, you necessarily have to look at the facts of the case. You have to figure out exactly what was stolen, perhaps how it was stolen, who the victims were. It's clear in our criminal code that the legislature wants a court to consider the nature of the victims, if they're older, if they're younger, if they're children. In a sex offense, for example, there are far different considerations. The code also expresses the will of the legislature to consider whether or not a first-time offender is drug addicted, for a shorthand. I mean, it's stated slightly differently, but a first-time drug offender is entitled to different consideration, which is precisely what Mr. Foster was.
Okay, well, so, let me back you up a minute. You seem to say that Blakely required that everybody gets the minimum. And that anything that takes you out of that is a jury question.
Here's what Justice.
And I don't think that's what Scalia said in Blakely. In fact, he went out of his way to claim that this isn't the death knell for determinate sentencing.
That's correct.
Now, when you get to Fanfan, he, I believe, wants to simply just over knock out the entire sentencing structure and have Congress start over.
Correct.
While other dissenters want to attack the requirement of Blakely.
Correct.
On, and the majority, I believe, is saying, we're turning the federal guidelines into recommendations and taking away the de novo review. Don't they leave the federal system about exactly where our system is without any tinkering?
No, Your Honor, and I'll tell you why. There's an observation by Justice Scalia and Blakely that says, and it's completely applicable to Mr. Foster. If Ralph Blakely walked into that courtroom after admitting to the second-degree felonies, and the judge had sentenced him to the 90 months, and Ralph Blakely walked out without the judge saying another word, his case automatically would have been reversed. The judge had to make certain findings in that case that Blakely employed deliberate cruelty to up the sentence. So too in Mr. Foster's case, had Mr. Foster gone before the trial court and the trial court had said, rather than the 2 years to which the statutes and the various presumptions and entitlements mandate, I'm going to sentence you to 9, case over, I have little doubt that the Fifth District would have immediately reversed because the appropriate findings, factual findings, were not made by the trial court. So in that regard, they're identical. In each case, Mr. Foster's case and Mr. Blakely's case, the trial court had to make additional findings based on what the trial court found by a preponderance of the evidence, not beyond a reasonable doubt, were the facts of the case.
And you don't believe those are significantly different kinds of findings that the trial court has to make under the Ohio sentencing scheme than they were in the Washington sentencing scheme?
That's correct, Your Honor. You can call it deliberate cruelty. We submitted supplemental authority, I believe in Maine, for example. There the trial court found that it was a particularly heinous offense, which I would submit corresponds to our worst form of the offense. Very similar, the key factor is it doesn't matter, and this is abundantly clear in Blakely and in Booker, that it doesn't matter what you call it. You can call it a sentencing factor. You can call it an aggravating factor. You can call it a fact. Whatever you call it, if it relies on the facts of the case and it increases the sentence, the defendant has a right to have a jury make that determination, and the determination has to be beyond a reasonable doubt.
What evidence would you offer for a jury to make a conclusion about the worst form of the offense? Do you think you could put in all kinds of extraneous evidence of other cases to a jury?
No, Your Honor. I think, in fact, I would submit that a jury is most qualified. It is the suffrage of your peers that should decide, and I'll tell you why, because—
Based on what evidence?
Based on the facts of the case, because the Ohio courts have consistently found that worst form of the offense isn't the worst ever. It's not a comparative analysis where you say, well, the worst form of a burglary occurs when the defendant does this precise act. It's
what
always
evidence
been,
would be admitted for a prosecutor to show it's the worst and for a defense lawyer to show it's not the worst?
The what transpired, again using a burglary as an example, if the defendant went in and trashed the house and spray painted obscenities all over the place, and the victim was 89 years old and was terrorized by the whole event, that would be the worst form of the events offense. And a jury could make that finding because just as a judge, they would be able to evaluate the nature of the facts as opposed to the standard burglary both these would be aggravated burglaries, where the defendant goes in and
problem.
Simply
And you want us to make a rule that says that the jury finding the guilt or the innocence should consider all of these matters before they determine guilt or innocence. Is that what you're asking us to do?
Yes, Your Honor, because I'm asking you.
So before the defendant has been found guilty, you want the jury to make a determination about all of these findings that are contained in the statute on sentencing?
Well, that would be up to the legislature to design how to do that.
What is the relief that you seek in this case from this court?
The relief I seek in this case is reversal of Mr. Foster's sentence because he was denied his right to have a jury determine whether or not his crimes demeaned.
But my question then is, you want this to be decided by the jury determining his guilt or innocence before he's been found guilty. You want them to determine sentencing factors. That's what you want.
What I want, Your Honor, is for Ohio to enact a procedure that allows, like a gun specification, it would be no different. The prosecutor would have to give notice by specifying that this was the worst form of the offense, or that the
seriousness. Well, we do that with some of the sentencing factors.
Correct.
You want it to be done with all of them?
Yes. For example, in Mr. Foster's case, had there been notice to Mr. Foster that he was going to be found to have created great harm, or that the seriousness of his offense was such that a lesser sentence or the entitled sentence would demean the seriousness of his conduct, he should have notice of that so he can contest that.
So you want us to say that the findings that the legislature now has incorporated for a trial court to make are unconstitutional in accordance with either Blakely or Fanfan or whatever decision or Apprendi, and then fashion a remedy along this line? Is that what you want us to do?
I don't know, to be quite honest with the court, with all due respect to this court's inherent authority, I don't know that this court can fashion a remedy. I think that's up to the legislature.
So we just declare it unconstitutional?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Counsel, if it is the responsibility of the prosecutor during the guilt phase of, and I'm presuming we're envisioning just one trial here, not a bifurcated guilt and then a sentencing phase, is that correct?
Again, Your Honor, I hate to hesitate with either question, but I can't overstate enough that it would be up to the legislature to figure out how to do this.
All right, but based on your response to Justice O'Donnell's question, that would be a finding for the jury to make, that this was either a benign crime or this was a heinous crime or somewhere in between, correct?
Correct.
All right. Now, how does a defense attorney maintain a defense that his client is innocent, and at the same time, if I am guilty, this was just a benign version?
Well, Your Honor, as I believe Blakely notes, I know I'm fairly certain Booker does as well, and as is the practice in this state, a defendant can always waive the specifications. He can admit to the specifications, and in fact, I think it's clear from Booker and from Judge Scalia's opinion in Blakely that the practical effect of this will probably be very limited. Most defendants plead guilty to the underlying offense. Most defendants, we can presume, will plead guilty, or some sort of bargain will be struck as to any aggravating factors.
We can't fashion law based on the gamble that somebody's going to plead guilty. Trials occur.
That's true, Your Honor, but that is the price you pay for the right to a jury trial. It's clear, and Justice Scalia says this quite eloquently, far more than I'm about to, at the conclusion of Blakely, and it's reiterated in Booker. The framers didn't pick an administrative decision on how to impose a sentence. This is not the most efficient way to sentence a criminal defendant. There is no doubt about that. And there will be jury trials, and it will cost money, and it will be occasionally inefficient. But the bedrock principle is the defendant has a right to have a jury of his peers determine every accusation against him, so that if the state is going to accuse him of committing the worst form of the offense, he has a right to have a jury determine that.
However, counsel, the situation here in Ohio, the judge has the authority to sentence within a statutory range. If we have an Apprendi, Blakely, Booker problem, the real problem is that the judge is required to make findings. I think all those cases are very clear that if the judge did not have to make those findings, if the judge had pure discretion to sentence within the range, there would be no problem. So one of the remedies that we could have, if we agree that there's a problem here constitutionally, is to sever the offending portions and allow the remainder of the statute to stand. Is that correct?
May I respond, Your Honor?
You may, sure.
I would disagree with Your Honor at the last part of what Your Honor said about severing. I don't believe that this court is empowered to do that.
What about the Geiger case? What about the Geiger case? We have authority that says if there is a constitutional defect in a statute, provided that the remainder of the statute can stand without the severed portion, and it can work, we can do that.
And that's precisely the problem here, Your Honor. You can't just sever a portion like the Supreme Court did in Booker. They basically took out the section that mandated certain.
We have the same thing, more than the minimum consecutive, arguably more than the minimum, the consecutive, overriding the guidance for community control in the lower level felonies. Those areas that your briefs have talked about, and you're particularly interested in the consecutives and the more than the minimum for Mr. Foster, correct? I mean, if we take care of that, if we say you cannot enforce the provisions that talk about the judge being required to make these findings, everything else can work.
Again, Your Honor, I'd submit it can't because of the way that Senate Bill 2 was structured. You would have to delete more than just a few shalls. You would have to arguably delete the entirety of Section 29, 29, 19.
Why?
Because you can't, it's an integrated whole. 29-5308, the appellate provision, you would have to alter that. You would have to essentially take a statute that was put together through the political process and contains political considerations, economic considerations such as the cost of incarceration, the need to protect the public, punish the offender, and yet at the same time not overburden our jails and our prisons. You can't pick here and there, cherry pick the sections that say shall and end up with a result intended by the legislature.
If we did that, we'd be doing the remedy that Booker required. Basically, we would be saying that these mandatory sections are now guidelines. This is discretion with the judge, and the judge has the power to sentence within the range, which 29, 11, and 12 already give guidance that would remain. The judge has all the rest of the statute to follow, and it could be done.
It could be done, Your Honor. My point is, though, that I think it would do an injustice to Senate Bill 2. Make no mistake, I am a fervent believer, as I think many or most of my colleagues in the defense bar are. Senate Bill 2 is a good bill. It's good for everyone. It's good for prosecutors. It's good for defendants because it strives for uniformity and fairness, and to protect the public, and to punish. And so if you start picking words out, you are going to do violence to that intent.
If we're going to follow Apprendi, Blakely, Booker, if we're going to follow the U.S. Supreme Court, we may have to do something. And this is all the other states that are considering their statutory schemes are wrestling with the same problem. You're basically getting rid of reforms that have been made in the past because the U.S. Supreme Court now says by requiring the judge to make these findings, you are taking away what the jury should have done.
That's true, Your Honor, but I would note, and this is clear from the supplemental authority, that the states that have determined their systems in violation of Blakely, such as Indiana, Maine, I believe Arizona, a couple others, they have given it back to the legislature because they have recognized the importance and the thought that went into the reform. And so they haven't, by and large, I'm
sure
there are exceptions.
Wouldn't a better approach to be following something that along the lines of Justice Lansinger's proposal to eliminate the offensive portions, and it still then is back in the court of the legislature for any kind of fix? There's nothing to prohibit them from taking a look at the statute as the court would then modify it and doing something about it. So, in essence, you have that recourse.
You have that recourse, Your Honor, but again, in the interim between trying to initiate the fix and picking out the parts that appear to violate the Constitution, you are basically tossing the purposes, the overriding purposes, and the goals behind sentencing out the window. Now, maybe the legislature would choose a way to reintegrate them, but I submit that that response would not be the correct response.
Counsel, your red light's on, but I have a couple of process and procedural questions, and these will come up throughout the morning, I'm sure. Going to the severability issue, first of all, we have severed on some occasions. On some occasions, we find that that's just too complicated in terms of, you know, what is left makes no sense. And I think your argument there is that our the problems, the Apprendi problems here, really don't create a severability kind of fix for us. I think that's your
correct
argument.
Your Honor.
The U.S. Supreme Court in Fanfan, in their severability, really rewrote the federal statute. It appeared to me they didn't just sever, but they filled in the gaps that were created from their severability. I don't know that we've done that in the past. The process question, we have a problem here. I don't think there's much question about that. The process question that I have, procedural question, is between the completion of a fix, if there needs to be one, whether it's by this court or this court and the legislature, however, the start of this, what defendants are in play? Do we have to go back to Apprendi? Because in Blakely, Scalia seems to be saying, we're just making it clear what we said to you all in Apprendi. So is our start point in terms of defendants who are in play on this in a case that was active starting with Apprendi, or is it with Blakely, or where is it? Or is it with this case?
I think here in Ohio, at least, the minimum line would be Blakely. And I say that based on the precedent I found in other courts. There's cogent reasoning for why you would not apply Apprendi if the state court has never found it to be applicable to the offense. So I think you would at least start with the defendants who began raising their Blakely claims when Blakely
was
announced. Correct.
All right.
I have a couple of questions, Ms. Hare. What impact do the Supreme Court cases have on consecutive sentencing?
Well, Your Honor, consecutive sentence is no different from the other mandatory minimums that are in the statute. You cannot, under the statute, you cannot impose consecutive sentences unless you make certain factual findings. In fact, I think just less than 2 weeks ago in Porterfield, that observation was made based on a clear reading of the statute.
So the argument that the jury, with respect to consecutive sentencing, the jury has made findings on each of the elements of the crime for which the person receives consecutive sentences, that's your response to that argument?
I'm not sure I follow
you. The argument is that with respect to the consecutive sentencing, that you don't have the same problems that you have with with the judge increasing the sentence, because the jury has what the court is doing is simply saying, here are five sentences and you're going to serve them consecutively rather than concurrently, but that the jury has made the requisite findings for the judge to make the sentence on, or to impose a sentence in each instance. That you don't follow the argument?
No, I think I do, Your Honor, and I maybe I apologize if I'm misunderstanding, but with the consecutive sentences, the same problem exists, because if the jury has found a defendant guilty of four grand theft autos and the judge is considering imposing consecutive sentences, certain factual findings have to be made, and so that takes it within the purview of Blakely.
And they're the same factual findings that have to be made with respect to increasing a sentence, is your argument? That's
correct, Your Honor.
Under the statute.
Although the states that have considered this consecutive argument, to my knowledge, there are none that have yet said that Blakely applies to consecutive sentences. Is that correct?
I would have
In California, Indiana, the cases.
I think that's correct.
I think that's correct, okay. Your Honor. Now, of course, California is, they took their statute out of the Blakely realm completely. But Indiana, I think that's correct.
Okay. Indiana, I think there's a recent Supreme Court case in Indiana that in which the court selected those sentencing factors that it determined to be unconstitutional and those that were constitutional, and struck only the unconstitutional ones. I take it from your earlier responses that you would advise us not to do that if we find that some but not all of the sentencing factors are unconstitutional.
Well, Your Honor, that's correct. I can't presume to tell you what the history of the Indiana courts have been, Arizona, all the rest of them. I do know that this court has been very careful and very selective in how it alters a statute, because the court does not want to legislate,
We wouldn't be legislating by saying these factors are traditionally, judge sentencing factors. These these go to the jury under Blakely. That's just a matter of saying one's constitutional, one is not, and letting the General Assembly then decide what to do about it. isn't that right?
That's correct,
Your Honor. We should attempt to save the statute. Isn't there a principle in law that courts attempt to find statutes unconstitutional if they can?
That's not correct.
Our purpose here, to declare an entire scheme of sentencing unconstitutional if we don't have to.
That's correct.
Okay.
Counsel, you envision then a very limited role for the trial judge at sentencing.
Correct. Not one
that involves discretion or any of the attributes that a judge is supposed to possess and employ in doing their job.
I answer too quickly, Your Honor. I envision under our system a more limited role for the judge in making those mandatory findings. Your Honor, I would note there's a good short recitation of the history in Booker, both in Justice Stevens and in Justice Breyer's opinions, talking about how when the Republic was founded, sentences was pretty harsh. You steal a horse, you get hung. Kill a man, you're hung. As time went on in the 19th century, rehabilitation became the norm. And so as a result, judges were entrusted with the ability to evaluate, were given the authority to evaluate the amenability of a particular defendant, and by necessity evaluate the person's character to determine whether or not they could be rehabilitated. Those particular factors are still in play. Whether or not a person, the public needs to be protected, for example, from a particular individual may, under certain circumstances, be the province of the judge, because you're looking forward. But with sentencing reforms, we drifted away, as the opinions note, from rehabilitation to punishment. And when that happened, the Sixth Amendment values requiring accusations to be proven to a jury came back into play, thereby limiting the judge's ability to willy-nilly make all determinations pertinent to sentencing.
But don't you think that Sentencing Bill 2 took that into consideration.
I don't
all of the purposes or intentions that you just mentioned, this was, as you stated earlier, good for everybody.
That's correct.
Defendants, prosecutors, et cetera, the public, the victims, et cetera, where there's a balance that is attempted to be struck here between the use of community control, the burden on the criminal justice system, the burden on the Department of Rehab and Corrections. That's all attempted to be balanced here by virtue of this sentencing bill.
That's correct.
So the considerations that you're discussing may have shifted and with the historical analysis of our criminal justice system, but here in Ohio, through this sentencing bill, we've attempted to strike a balance.
Your Honor, overall, I agree with that. The problem is that not just Ohio, the federal government, the states throughout the land have gone through the same process, made the same judgments, attempted to achieve the same goals. And yet here we are, and this goes back to why you really can't, I think, start consideration of when defendants should have raised these issues until Blakely. Because I think Blakely was the court suddenly stepping back and saying, look at what has happened across the land. We have shifted to punishment rather than rehabilitation, and this is a problem. So yes, every state that has enacted sentencing reform and the federal government, all these considerations came into play, and mine's far smarter than I would claim to be, to determine the best way to handle criminal defendants. And yet, when they made the system more punitive, that caused a problem, because in doing so, when the system becomes more punitive based on accusations, the right to a jury comes into play. And for that reason, as good as the bill is, it's constitutionally flawed.
Thank you, Ms. Hare.
Thank you.
Mr. Oswald. Mr. Oswald, let me tell you that, and you and Ms. Bry, that we took Ms. Hare well beyond the 15 minutes allotted, and I'll give you extra time if there are questions from the court.
May it please the court. My name is Kenneth Oswald. I'm with the Licking County Prosecutor's Office. Together with Ms. Bry from the Attorney General's Office, I have the privilege of representing the state of Ohio in this matter. Because of the importance of the constitutional issues this court has to decide, I've decided to split my time with Ms. Bry because I believe it's important that this court hear from the representative of the Attorney General's Office. With that intention is my desire to speak for several minutes about a waiver issue and whether Apprendi and Blakely are subject to waiver analysis. Not because that's more important, but because it's not less important. And the reason it's not less important, I would surmise that the vast majority of cases that will find its way to the Court of Appeals that already have done so, or the cases that run the risk of being reopened based upon the court's decision in this matter, will raise issues of waiver, something that the appellant has not discussed this morning. In this particular case, the facts of this case would show that a defendant who on September 25th, 2003, some 3 years after Apprendi was decided, entered no contest plea to 26 separate felony offenses. In doing so, he completed 26 separate plea forms. On each of those, he acknowledged that the maximum prison sentence was either 12 months for the felonies of the fifth degree, 18 months for the felonies of the fourth degree, or 8 years for the felony of the second degree, with absolutely no mention on the record or on any one of these 26 forms, any expectation of any presumptive sentence except for one. And the presumptive sentence was a presumption for prison on the felony of the second degree.
Well, counsel, so Scalia discusses waiver and says you can clearly waive the Sixth Amendment kinds of issues, but finds in that case that he didn't. And my take on that is that to have waiver, your defendant here would have to say, I'm waiving my Sixth Amendment right to have a jury trial on any findings of fact that the judge is going to make in arriving at the sentence that the judge is going to impose. And you don't have that waiver in this case.
Your Honor, I would suggest that that specific of a waiver is not necessary, nor is
I think Scalia is very clear about that.
In this particular case, the defendant's waiver was unlimited, and in all the cases that involved a plea, which would be Apprendi and Blakely, the defendants did something at the trial level to preserve this issue. This defendant did nothing. At the conclusion of the proceedings, the defense counsel was asked by the court, do you have anything else? No, sir.
Let me ask you a question beyond waiver. What's your take on what the Supreme Court says about raising the Blakely issue, call it that, on habeas?
I believe that the United States versus Cotton opinion and the reference in Booker Fanfan that this issue, Apprendi issue, is subject to the provincial doctrines regarding plain error suggest that these issues are subject to plain error. Incidentally, in the case of United States versus Cotton, when they applied a plain error analysis, because that defendant had not waived the matter in the trial court, they pointed out that the Apprendi decision, which came down in 2000, came out during the direct appeal of Cotton's direct appeal. They nonetheless decided that Mr. Cotton was not entitled to the benefit of that, applying the plain error analysis. There's no reason, because Blakely comes out in a situation while this defendant or appellant is on direct appeal, that the same thing shouldn't result. As a matter of fact, this defendant could have done exactly what Mr. Blakely's attorney did in August of 2000, that is, litigate this issue based upon Apprendi. And we might have Ohio versus Foster instead of Blakely versus Washington. But just because Blakely's attorney was able to do something that 3 years before this defendant entered pleas is no excuse to say this defendant couldn't have done it. As a matter of fact, an examination of Westlaw indicates that prior to this man entering his pleas, there were no less than 36 Ohio appellate cases that dealt with Apprendi. In addition—
Let me come back to my question on habeas. My take from the Supreme Court cases is they're saying federal habeas is not going to be available.
It's not going to be available.
Am I understanding that correctly? They're saying you had to raise this on direct appeal.
That's my understanding, yes, sir.
Okay. And you would recommend, I take it, as a prosecutor, that we not make the state of habeas available?
I would, and for several reasons. I know of no case law that requires when a judge asks a defendant, do you waive your right to jury trial, or do you waive your right to compulsory process, or do you waive your right to confront witnesses, to include within each and every one, and oh, by the way, sir, do you understand that by waiving your right to a jury trial, you're waiving your right to have 12 people decide you're guilty, and it has to be unanimous. And oh, by the way, when you waive your constitutional right to confront witnesses, that includes your right to object to hearsay issues that might be confrontation problems. And oh, by the way, when you waive your right to compulsory process, do you know that there are procedures whereby you can subpoena out-of-state witnesses? And do you know that this includes your waiving your right to subpoena records if you wanted records to support your defense? There is absolutely no court that I know of that requires that kind of breakdown of the specific details. So when a defendant comes in and says, Your Honor, I'm waiving my jury trial rights and does nothing, and I mean nothing, to preserve an issue for sentencing. And in addition to doing that, on every one of these forms, there's absolutely no reference to any expectation of community control. Instead, in every instance, the maximum sentence of 12 months, maximum sentence of 18 months, or the maximum sentence of 8 years is the only mention in these forms. If that's not a waiver, I would suggest that when a defendant is simply asked, you waive your right to compulsory process, we've got a problem, because you didn't go far enough. So in this particular case, this is an unlimited, completely no reservation of limitations whatsoever.
Counsel, until June 24th, 2004, no one thought that the Apprendi principles were going to be applied to sentencing. Not until that date. So you argue waiver and what someone's giving up when someone doesn't know, because no one knows that this is an issue or a right. How can we talk about waiver before that date?
You're talking about the date Blakely came out.
Right.
I can talk about it as waiver because prior to Blakely coming out, there were 36 Ohio cases that dealt with it. Prior to Blakely...
Apprendi, but Apprendi's talking about the conviction, not about sentencing.
No, Apprendi talks about sentencing criteria. Apprendi talks about an issue of a defendant being convicted of a crime, and then as a matter of sentencing, it's elevated because of racial bias by the judge.
Okay, but we're not talking about the judicial findings. In the same sense that Blakely is talking about. Apprendi and Blakely are different. I mean, we have many commentators talking about the new rule, the unusual case that Blakely okay. is.
All I can tell you is that Blakely stemmed from an Apprendi challenge. Blakely didn't exist when Mr. Blakely's attorney made his claim. He relied upon mm-hmm. Apprendi. I can also point out that in the Apprendi decision, in a prior case, United States versus Jones, Justice Kennedy points out that this progeny on where it's going is going to run a risk for states that have tried to put in uniform criteria to make sentences more uniform, and Justice Kennedy specifically makes mention of the possibility of various states, including Ohio's reference to serious physical harm as a sentencing criteria. When you get to Ring versus Arizona, Justice O'Connor points out that by that time, which is 2002, again, a year before the appellant has any reason to is in front of the court, she points out there are over 1,800 appellate decisions in the federal courts already and countless state court decisions that are finding their way through on Apprendi. Blakely didn't come out of anywhere, or of nowhere. As a matter of fact, the United States Supreme Court twice says that the Blakely opinion were foreshadowed, and they use that word twice, by Jones versus United States, a 1999 case. So to suggest that Blakely is some aberration that came out of nowhere, especially since it was raised as an Apprendi claim, is just not accurate in my
estimation. So you would disagree that it articulates a new rule? I mean, that's your position.
I would disagree. It is the same rule being applied to a different statutory scheme, and that's it. With that, Your Honor, I would refer the balance of my time to...
May I just ask you one other question? Since this was a plea, what is your position if this were a trial?
With respect to what specifically?
There'd be no waiver in a trial situation.
That's correct. Well, it could be. I suppose there could be. My position then would come back to the argument that Ms. Bry was going to address, that Blakely doesn't apply to Ohio. These findings that...
So your position is basically if a defendant enters a plea, all this is waived, and if there's a trial, it just doesn't apply.
That would be correct. And the reason for that is one of the things that seems to be forgotten or lost is Apprendi and Blakely doesn't simply talk about findings made by the judge. It talks in terms of findings that are the, quote, functional equivalent of elements. To say that something demeans the seriousness of the offense, which, by the way, isn't applicable to our case here, that is if you oppose the maximum sentence. But let's use that as an example. That is not the functional equivalent of the offense. That's not, did the offense occur with racial bias, which would be Apprendi? Did this offense involve physical harm on the carjacking statute, which I think is Jones? Is this a criteria that elevates it to a death penalty eligible offense, which is Ring versus Arizona? These are qualitative analysis or determinations or judgments based upon things a jury couldn't possibly have a frame of reference. When we talk about the things that are relevant to this case, that is a defendant amenable to community control? Is this offense consecutive sentences proportionate and the like? That requires a sentencer to be able to look out of the facts of this case toward other cases. And for example, and I'll end on this one, if we're going to have the determination that a judge says this defendant is not amenable to community control, how is a jury going to come up to that same conclusion? Am I, as a prosecutor, going to have to present, as you suggested, evidence, well, in Licking County, we have a community-based correction facility?
Maybe Ohio has to do, if we find against you, that, as I think Kansas has, that has provided for a bifurcated process, guilt phase, mitigation, and sentencing phase.
There are several problems with that. First of all, this court
there are a lot of problems with it, but go ahead.
Okay, there are a lot of problems. Okay. There are a lot of problems with it, one of which the court has already determined that as currently existed under the statute and as legislative intent, the intent of the legislature was not to have juries decide all of these factors or these issues. That's a Mason case. More importantly, or just as importantly at least, is we want some certainty here. That's why I began this by saying I would like the court to rule on the merits and on the waiver, because you're going to deal with these cases, and the courts are going to deal with these cases for years if you don't. But if the court concludes that there's a problem with our statute, for you not to do in Ohio what the United States Supreme Court has sanctioned in Booker is just going to increase, whether it's in federal courts or state courts.
But we've got language, I think, in Apprendi that says any finding which would increase a sentence must be made by a jury. Do we just disregard that and say, well, it doesn't make any difference because we'll let the judge do it?
No, but you have to put it in context with the language in the same opinion, that the functional equivalent of an element. Because you can't read one part of that opinion and make sense out of it. Because if
don't tell those guys in Washington that.
I'm talking about you folks, not the legislatures. All I'm saying is you cannot read one passage out of the context of the other, because if you did, these opinions would basically say there is absolutely no basis for the court to ever make factual conclusions or determinations of a person's suitability for community control.
Since our statute requires the trial court to make findings and not the jury, can we presume it to be constitutional, or do we have to start with a basis from Apprendi and Ring and Blakely and Fanfan that says these guidelines are not constitutional? Where's our beginning point?
Okay, if you're talking about the factors related to felonies of the fourth and fifth degree, which is applicable to this case,
yes.
I'm suggesting that the court technically has to make no finding under those 13 in order to impose prison. The way the statute is written is you have to find one of these factors. If you find one of these factors, you find prison consistent with the overriding principles of sentencing, and he's not amenable, then you have to send him to prison. On the reverse side, if you find that don't make one of these 13 findings and you find him amenable, you have to give him community control. If the person falls in the middle, you have complete discretion. So if the first Paul falls in the middle, you have complete discretion, so that these factors or findings do not define the statutory maximum for Apprendi purposes. The court can make all findings in the world, absent some equal protection issues, as long as it doesn't change the statutory maximum.
Thank you, Mr. Oswald. Ms. Bry.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, I'm Diane Bry, here on behalf of Attorney General Jim Petro as amicus supporting the state of Ohio. We heard from Ms. Hare today that any findings that increase a penalty must go to a jury. But what we haven't heard is what a trial on the findings required by the Ohio statute would look like. In other words, what would a jury have to consider to decide in the case of maximum sentence what is the worst form of the offense, or in the case of consecutive sentences, whether concurrent sentences or single sentences would be, that consecutive sentences would not be disproportionate to the seriousness of the offender's conduct and the danger it poses to the public. This kind of trial is the sort of trial that one could imagine would be fairly extensive, would involve comparative judgments across the board about types of crimes in the state or what would be necessary for punishment. This isn't what we think of as a normal jury trial process.
Counsel, that doesn't seem to be helpful as a way to analyze the Blakely problem. I mean, Blakely says it's a pretty clear rule. It's not hard to understand what the rule is. when you get to practical application, so I have the same question of you that I had of counsel for the defendant. The Supreme Court, who decided this case, has made a practical application of it in Fanfan, in Breyer's opinion. So where have they left it there? How's it going to work? My take on that is that they've said the as long as we treat these from this point forward as recommendations, as worthy and lofty goals, and not binding on the federal courts, the federal courts can go right on sentencing without any further action by Congress. Is that what they've said in Fanfan?
In the Booker-Fanfan decision, of course, you have two aspects of the opinion, and the part Your Honor's referring to is the remedial part, where Justice Breyer and that majority determined that certain provisions of the act would be severed, so that effectively what you have is a discretionary system. And yes, that is what the court
so
did.
So in applying their own rule, and now Ginsburg switches from one group of five to the other group of five is what appears to happen, because the rest of the folks that decided Blakely seem to think you just have to strike down the whole federal statute. And start, well, some do, and some think you can tack this rule on. But as a practical matter, when they apply their own rule, they simply turn the federal guidelines into aspirational goals, and it's over, isn't it, for the federal defendants in the application of this rule?
Well, for the federal defendants, certainly now that it's a discretionary system, there are some issues with cases that are in the pipeline, so to speak, up to this point on a going forward basis in the federal system.
That's what I'm asking about. Is
discretionary system.
So if we are looking at this rule that they have announced and trying to decide how do we apply it if we determine there is a structural problem in our sentencing scheme, we can strike down the whole sentencing scheme. We can do as a couple of the justices have suggested, sever anything that seems to offend the rule. Because isn't most of ours in the category of a recommendation rather than a mandate? In the category that the problem they have with the federal statute is there was no discretion. Isn't that where they were when they started out in applying it to the federal sentencing scheme?
The court decided unanimously that the problem, the only problem that could be posed under the rule in Booker was if the federal sentencing guidelines were mandatory. And so that's how they resolved that problem in that case, was rendering them discretionary, which is
Is what Justice Kennedy has wanted to do for some time, and so he finally is the big winner, isn't he, in terms of how the federal system ends up. But our system, as it exists today, is not quite like the federal system in terms of it being mandatory, is it?
That's correct. There are a number of differences between Ohio's system and the federal system. One is, of course, that we are not a guideline state, unlike Washington and unlike the federal system. Another is that we have one standard range for each level of felony, that the judge chooses a sentence within that range. That, again, is a difference in our system, as we address in the brief. Also, as we talked about a few moments ago, the findings, many of the findings under the Ohio statute, they're called findings by the statute, but they're not factual findings that approximate elements of the crime, unlike Apprendi, unlike Blakely, and unlike Booker, where you have racial bias, deliberate cruelty, drug quantity. These things look like elements of the offense. Considerations like worst form of the offense and whether an offender is likely to offend again, which the latter, of course, is classic recidivism, which is a traditional sentencing factor, those just don't look like those element of the offense type findings. And a jury trial on that would be not because juries couldn't make that determination if presented with the evidence, but it would be a lengthy trial process, unwieldy, and in effect what you might be saying, if all of that, including prediction of what the offender might do in the future, goes to a jury, that effectively, if the judge can't make those determinations as judges have traditionally done, effectively you're saying those determinations can't be made as part of your sentencing system just because of the cost involved.
Counsel, it seems to me we have three choices, maybe more. We can look at all of this and say, we don't have a Blakely problem in Ohio at all, period. End of story. Is that what you're recommending?
That is one of the arguments, certainly, that we've made.
Is that a good
structurally,
argument?
Structurally, it's... There are,
I mean, because if we make that determination, that's going to be tested elsewhere. And,
no
and,
doubt.
And it serves no one if elsewhere it's determined we're wrong about that. So we need to be right on that. And so wouldn't that require us, even to make that determination, to go through the sentencing scheme on every kind of defendant to determine, because we have multiplicity of them. We have the sexual offenders where we have all of this gradation and determinations of what your status is. Wouldn't we, to say, we have, to announce that we have a clean bill of health applying Blakely, don't we have to go through all of those statutes to see if we have a Blakely problem when it comes to sentencing any kind of a defendant for any kind of crime in Ohio?
Your Honor, if the court were to decide that structurally Ohio's system is different from the system in Washington and the federal system, because it isn't a guideline system and because there is one statutory range for each level of felony, therefore the statutory maximum is the maximum in that range, I don't believe that would require you to go through every potential application or every potential case that might come up to decide constitutionality, if I understood Your Honor's question correctly. Of course, as I mentioned a moment ago, many of the findings are not traditional, or our traditional sentencing factors are not the sort of findings that you have in Blakely. When you look at a statute with its presumption of constitutionality, as you have in Ohio under case law and under Section 1.47, you look at that and the differences between our system and the Washington system and decide that if it's not absolutely covered by Blakely, then it ought to be upheld, not struck down in toto.
In your view, has the Supreme Court in any of the opinions given us any guidance regarding which sentencing factors are reserved by the judge, by the court, and which must be decided by the jury? As you pointed out, the factors in the cases before the Supreme Court were fairly objective. I mean, the quantity of drugs, for example, that's easy for the jury to determine. But the sentencing factors in the Ohio statute are far more subjective, it seems to me. And as you suggest, would extend trials enormously, it seems to me, to bring in experts about recidivism, for example. That would be a very difficult issue, it seems to me, for a jury. I guess juries could decide that. But is there language in any of the Supreme Court cases to which you could direct us that gives us a wider berth than we seem to hear from the defense counsel?
Well, certainly there's the language to start in Blakely itself that says, other than a fact of a prior conviction. And then it goes on to say any fact that increases the penalty. So certainly you can begin with the idea that prior convictions, which is also consistent with the Almendarez-Torres case, which is still the law of in U.S. Supreme Court, that prior convictions, the fact of a prior conviction, and we suggest related items that relate to recidivism, which in U.S. versus Harris, U.S. versus Jones, as well as Almendarez-Torres, the court has recognized recidivism factors are traditional sentencing factors. implying that was one of the reasons why in Almendarez-Torres that the prior conviction exception or the prior convictions need not go to a jury. So the factors in the maximum sentence, in the consecutive sentence, consecutive sentencing provision, all of those that relate to whether the defendant's likely to reoffend, whether it's likely to protect the public, those seem to me to be classic recidivism factors, and those should be outside the problematic areas at a minimum. Additionally, of course, the Supreme Court's cases talked about facts that have been admitted by the defendant or are determined by the jury, those that are implicit in the jury's verdict. So again, if the defendant has admitted certain facts, then of course there's no need to have a jury determination under the Blakely rule. So those facts as well, whatever the type of fact it is, those would not be a problem. And for example, here you have a situation where at the plea colloquy, I believe the assistant prosecutor laid out a fairly extensive factual basis for that plea. And the court then turned to the defendant, I think it was around page 17 or 18 of that transcript, and said, well, do you agree with these facts? And the defendant said, yes, I do. Well, when you have admitted facts, the court can look at those facts, certainly, and make decisions about whether he can make the conclusions that the other Ohio sentencing statutes require based on those facts. That would be, I think, fairly uncontroversial under Blakely and not,
the counsel,
not concluded by it.
And Blakely, the problem was facts that were not admitted. It wasn't the admitted facts that caused the problem. And doesn't the Supreme Court go out of its way, not out of its way, but it puts a good deal of effort into saying you don't get around this Sixth Amendment problem by saying this fact doesn't relate to an element of the crime. They're pretty precise in their language about that, saying you aren't going to solve any problems that this case calls for you by just putting a different set of clothes on it and then saying the judge can decide that fact. And isn't that our practical problem, is that we're going to have to give careful scrutiny to everything? I mean, maybe we're fine. Maybe we should conclude after doing that. But doesn't the Blakely decision require us to go over the sentencing scheme as it applies to everything from vicious dogs to aggravated murder to determine whether or not a fact is involved in the judge's determination that should be left to the jury?
To answer Your Honor's question, the court in Blakely did say that just what the legislature labels a fact is not determinative. If the legislature labels it a sentencing fact rather than an element, but if as an apprendi it really functions in the same way, of course it's going to be subject to the analysis. But again, if the court finds that structurally Ohio's system is different because of the maximum range is within the standard range for each felony, then you wouldn't need to look at each particular application. And again, to follow on further response to Chief Justice Moyer's question, there are certain factual, even factual determinations that are not prohibited or not affected by Blakely. And there are some other courts that have looked at, other state courts have looked a little bit at some of these other factors, although they've come out to varying conclusions on whether things really are conclusions or facts under their systems.
Are there any findings in the statute that you think are elemental findings that must be made by a jury? Or are they all within the purview of the inherent authority of a sentencing court?
In the consecutive sentence statute, those look like conclusions. And I don't think they look like elemental facts. I mean, certainly when you're talking about something that's, whether assessing the danger the offender poses to the public, that's, one could hardly say that that's a traditional element of a crime or something that juries would look at in the fourth and fifth degree felon, whether a prison term is imposed, a finding about amenability or lack of amenability to community control sanctions certainly doesn't look like an element of an offense and looks like a predictive judgment about how this offender will respond to punishment or what's the appropriate punishment. So I think that certainly a distinction can be made there, and as Mr. Oswald said, under that 29-29-13B statute, that's only even that finding only becomes consequential if the judge makes the finding to put him in the box of saying you must do community control or you must do a prison term. If there no findings are made, then the judge can choose whatever he or she wishes in the judge's discretion. So those operate differently in this case. And finally, I would say just on consecutive sentences that other courts, including some of the federal circuits cited in our brief, have, and I think as some of the members of the court have suggested, all the state courts, I believe, who've addressed it have concluded that consecutive sentencing schemes are not subject to the same problems as in Blakely, simply because Blakely and Apprendi were dealing with the maximum sentence on a single count rather than.
So you're looking for a rule from our court that says that because these are not elemental findings, Blakely, Apprendi, Fanfan are cases that are inapplicable to Ohio's sentencing structure because the findings that are called on to be made for imposing more than a minimum sentence are inherently judicially to be imposed and not the province of a jury, and therefore you want us to determine this to be a constitutional structure as it is. Am I right?
That's correct, Your Honor. That is one of our arguments. That's
although right. Wasn't there a statement made in, I believe it was the Blakely decision, Blakely or Booker, that said the real problem here is that you are forcing the judge to make these findings. And if it was a purely discretionary matter, there would be no problem whatsoever. So isn't our real concern, or might it not be that because the judge is being forced to make findings on the record, and we know why that Senate Bill 2 suggested that, but the mere fact that the judge is being forced to make these findings on the record is what is violative of these cases. And that if we got rid of the shall and made it may or consider, the court should consider but not be binding, if the legislature, for example, were to change it in that way, we would not have a problem.
Your Honor, certainly if this court were to determine that there is a constitutional problem with Ohio's sentencing scheme or some part of it, one of the ways to deal with that would certainly be to read the shall as may, and then that would get you to about the same place that the court in Booker reached with respect to the federal guidelines. That is to say, these would then be advisory, discretionary with the judge. Severing certain parts of it, which we've noted some of the parts in our brief, would be another way to get to that, would also be consistent with the General Assembly's direction to presume a statute's constitutional, but also to do what one can do to save the statute. Now, those would be several remedial options open to the court, certainly.
One of the findings a court could make is that someone is a repeat violent offender. Is that more elemental in your view, or is that, again, in the discretion of a sentencing judge?
The repeat violent offender, to the extent it is based, I'll speak generally, that isn't involved in this case, but I will speak generally. To the extent it's based on prior convictions and you're looking at facts of prior convictions, then that direction from the court, I think, would come into play also in Blakely, that the fact of a prior conviction is not a problem for Blakely purposes. So that would certainly be applied when you're looking at that statute.
The same with the major drug offenders?
Major drug offenders, if I'm not mistaken, that is also could involve the prior convictions, but it also might involve a jury finding of the drug quantity that the judge would then apply, and that, I think, would not pose.
Although the RVO and the MDO right now, as a practical matter, are usually attached as a specification to the indictment, are they not?
They are.
Because
they
we're
are.
Talking about going over the statutory range of 1 to 10 years on a felony one, or excuse me, 3 to 10 years on an F1.
Right, because those would be the instances, unlike what we're talking about here with the standard statutory range, where you actually do go over it. That looks more like a Blakely situation, but again, you still have things based on prior convictions or based on if the jury's made a finding that would not be a problem under those statutes either.
Thank you, Ms. Bry.
Thank you.
Ms. Hare, you've gone well over your time, but start with 2 minutes.
Counsel, in your opinion, what issues under the line of Supreme Court cases are left for a judge's discretion?
I think, Your Honor, that, for example, amenable to community control is a good example of one that is left to the judge's discretion, because that is something that has traditionally been a consideration of the court, and that is something that a court arguably is uniquely poised to consider.
But you've made the argument that he has to get the minimum sentence unless the facts are submitted to the jury. Why is that then different than the other things you are insisting have to be submitted to the jury? The judge says he's not amenable to community control, so he's going to get more than a minimum sentence. Why is that different as a finding? You're refusing to draw a distinction between elements findings and findings regarding length of a sentence. Why is that different as a finding?
That's different as a finding because it doesn't rely on the facts of the case. The judge is not looking backward at what transpired when the incident occurred. He's looking forward, determining based on prior convictions or other considerations whether or not the person's amenable. I know that the state is arguing that worst form of the offense, for example, or harm caused by the offense can't be determined by a jury, and I'm always struck by that argument because every day prosecutors throughout this state argue to a jury that they are capable of considering aggravated factors and weighing them against mitigating factors and determining whether a person lives or dies, and yet they're claiming that the same jurors can't look at the harm caused by a particular offense and determine whether or not a person should go to jail for a fifth-degree felony.
If we take the Booker solution and say that the shalls are really only discretionary, have you won the battle and lost the war? Because now your clients have lost the ability to have a judge state on the record why they're being sentenced the way they are.
I would submit we've all lost the war because it guts many of the purposes for defendants. Uniformity. I can tell the court I've worked on a single county docket with multiple judges, and I've worked throughout the state as a state public defender. And you can be before one judge and receive one sentence based on the discretion of the court that is entirely different from the judge down the hall. Or if you're standing in, say, a Delaware county and you commit a crime, you receive one sentence, whereas if you step across the line into Franklin County, you get a different sentence based purely on discretion.
But that is exactly what the Supreme Court has done in the federal system. They have done just that, taken the mandatories and said, it's purely up to the judge now. And that, they have ruled, is a constitutional solution, have they not?
They have, Your Honor, based on the federal guidelines, which, as counsel admitted minutes ago, has significant differences with Ohio system.
Worse. And it was stricter, stronger, worse. Ours is a gentler, kinder version. So they have a worse problem in saying it's just discretionary than we have.
Well, but the Supreme Court is also capable of looking through reams and reams of legislative history and intent, as they did in Booker, as Judge Breyer did in Booker, and all the commission findings and whatnot to make this determination. This court has never done that. Indeed, there isn't any access to speeches by senators or comments by congressmen. It's basically what's stated in 29-29-12. That's what we have before us, and those are the purposes and the overriding considerations. So to try and pick parts of the statute apart, I think does disservice to our statute, where it may be fine for the federal system because the Supreme Court had the ability to glean various considerations from other material. It doesn't exist here in Ohio.
Well, the Sentencing Commission has prepared a felony report before Senate Bill 2 that was available to the legislature. So there was something similar, although I understand your point here. But the question is, as Justice Stratton has stated, we have the Booker example before us as a constitutional way to remedy any problem that we may see. And basically, I mean, if we were to accept your arguments that there were constitutional violations and we were to sever or we were to decide that this is a purely discretionary situation, as other parts of the statute have said, it's up to the judge to determine the best way to sentence within the range. I mean, your clients basically could obtain the same sentence if we were to order resentencing on that ground. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. And that I understand to Bookerize, for lack of a better word, the Ohio statute is tantalizing because of its apparent relative ease in solving this problem. That would be an easy way to resolve the problem before the court. But I submit to the court that it does an injustice to the reform that was enacted. Now, true, it takes care of what I sense is the elephant in the room, which is all these defendants who are in the pipeline, either in their appeals or awaiting sentences. Certainly nobody wants to give them a windfall because of the statute's constitutional flaws. That is unfortunate, but to just simply eviscerate the heart of the reform that was enacted by our legislature by saying, oh, it's all discretionary, and essentially taking us right back to where we were, I submit to the court does a disservice and would not be the solution. I understand the complexity of the solution that has to be wrought, and I know other states have struggled with it. There's no doubt about that, but I would urge the court not to just simply follow Booker as the means of solving this problem.
Thank you, Ms. Hare. Thank you, counsel. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.